second of the paramis is sila, or integrity, the perfection of morality. Sounds quite big. So recognizing that sila, or ethics, or integrity, is as much a practice of investigation and insight as any other of the paramis. It's a foundation of goodness and kindness in our hearts and our minds that allows for happiness, allows for calmness, and inclines the mind towards understanding. It's really too simplistic to think of ethics or sila as the observance of the five precepts, or the eight precepts, or the 237 precepts. It is too simplistic. I'm sure, you know, the five precepts, the five training guidelines of non-harming, not taking what is not freely offered, no sexual misconduct, not lying, not taking intoxicants. There, we all know it's quite possible for ourselves to, in a way, have an observance of those guidelines. And there's plenty of people in the world who are very austere and demanding moral codes, yet even amidst that we can be quite self-righteous, quite contracted, and quite judgmental. So sila, certainly the observance of the precepts, the training guidelines, is deeply, deeply important, because it turns back again to looking at what is going on in the mind. But that's not all there is to sila. I mean, certainly, it's interesting, if you look at the early suttas, the Buddha was not a terribly prescriptive person. You know, he didn't go around, you know, giving sermons on how people should live and what they should do and shouldn't do. What he really talked about was investigation, investigation, investigation. And he very much presented sila, or ethics, as being the basis of all harmonious, respectful communities and relationships, which I think is probably apparent to us. We would live in a very different world, of course, if the five training guidelines were universally acknowledged. But he also spoke about sila as the basis of a mind with an heart that is free of residues. This is the big one, free of residues. And the Buddha often described liberation as the freedom from residues. Now, what are residues? The residues are all of those wheels that we can spin in our minds of, if only I had done this, if only I didn't do this, I should have done this, I shouldn't have said that. Residues, what we see, you know, if we look at the wheels that our minds spin over and over again in terms of obsession or dwelling or preoccupation, residues are the basis of obsession. Residues are the basis of obsession. If there's no residues, there is no obsession. That the mind, and the Buddha was so clear in this, he says, the mind that is obsessed becomes agitated. And the mind that is agitated is far from freedom. He says the mind that doesn't obsess doesn't become agitated. And the mind that's not agitated is close to freedom. So the teaching, the parami of ethics, is really asking us to take care of the residues. To look at our ways of engaging with the world, and what are the ways of engaging the world that frees the mind, that leaves no residue. Because if we leave no residue, we are taking care of the mind's freedom from obsession, freedom from agitation, freedom from preoccupation. Upandita, some of you may have come across him, is quite a fairly stern teacher. He doesn't pull any punches. But one thing he said that I really admire, he once said to someone, how can you expect to deepen in meditation without sila? Because all that you're doing without sila, without ethics, is creating the condition for unpleasant states of mind to arise. So sila, or ethics, is really the condition of inner happiness and peace. And it's a condition for wise attention. It's so interesting to me that you know, when the Buddha said, in the mind of happiness, attention finds a true foundation. So instead of seeing happiness as being somehow a result of our practice, which it sometimes is, he actually sees this mind of happiness, this mind of well-being, as being the forerunner of wise practice and of deepening in practice. So as an insight practice, sila or integrity as an investigation is really inviting us to look at what states of mind, unskillful or unwholesome action arises from. Now, when we actually are willing to look at any moment, you know, where we've maybe spoken very harshly or thought very harshly or unkindly or fostered, you know, thoughts of vengeance or contractedness or rejection. When we look at those moments in our lives, and it would be a rare person who doesn't have these moments, by the way, when we look at those moments in our lives, what does unwholesome or unskillful thought, action, and speech arise from? It usually, in my experience, arises from the big three, you know, greed, hatred, and delusion. Usually arises from ill will, fear, which are parts of hatred. So sila, or ethics, is really asking us to look at these states that keeps us personally, and in reality keeps the whole of our world, tied to suffering. What are the states that keep us tied to suffering? Because this is not so much about being a good person or having, you know, a kind of, you know, creed that we've adopted. But what is it that ties us to suffering? What is it that ties much of the world to suffering? Now, what we also see, if we look at that kind of, you know, if we look underneath, you know, the words or the actions or the thoughts that we regret, and we maybe see some of the ill will or the greed or the delusion that's operating there, what we also see is that these are the places where the sense of I, the sense of self, is most pronounced. I'm sure you've noticed that. You know, have you noticed when there are moments of, or relationships, or times of kindness, of unhesitating compassion or generosity, have you noticed that the voice of I is very, very quiet? You know, the sense of self and other is very, very muted. But have you noticed in your experience that when there's a surge of greed or a surge of ill will, have you noticed how big the sense of me is? You know, it's a whoop. It's just that surge. And with that surge, you know, the sense of I, have you noticed how pronounced the sense of other is? So it's almost as if this whole world of separation, this whole world of selfing and othering, is actually really rooted in what we see as not sila, in greed, hatred, and delusion. So the Buddha, when he's talking about the importance of sila, the importance of ethics, he's really talking about bringing the end of that kind of division and estrangement, and easing the suffering of the moment. And again, this is often something that we do rather than what we feel. I probably keep coming back to this. There are, I think we could say, perhaps, you know, because sila is very much presented as a training. as I mentioned, not as a code, but as a training. I undertake the training in non-harming. So there's kind of three dimensions to this training. Now, the first of these, again, very unpopular, I would say, in our culture, is restraint. You know, certainly what I see in my experience is restraint is the forerunner of renunciation. It's the forerunner of renunciation. Now, restraint, again, as I mentioned, is the ways that we create moments of psychological opportunity. Restraint is the ways that we create the moments where we may have a possibility of conscious competence, of actually following a pathway that is born of clarity, that is born of intentionality, rather than a pathway of impulse and reactivity. Restraint is a practice. Before we speak, before we act, before we just follow that surge of selfing, what does it mean to pause? What does it mean to pause? Now, it takes a lot of courage to pause, because that's actually, you know, pulling the plug on I'm right and you're wrong. You know, it's pulling the plug on self-righteousness. It's pulling the plug on that feeling like, I really just have to tell you this. You know, I really just need to say that. You know, that sense of I must, you know, that compulsiveness of aversion. So restraint is actually pulling the plug on a lot of those habits, but it really is a practice, and there's no restraint without mindfulness. You know, without mindfulness, there's not the possibility of restraint. You know, it's not something we can determine. It is something that mindfulness actually allows for restraint. What are we restraining from? Well, we're not restraining from relatedness. We're not restraining from engagement. We're restraining from participating in unskillful acts of body, speech, and mind that bring harm to oneself or others. It's that simple. We're just restraining from it. We're restraining from acts that are, or thoughts or speech that are rooted in aversion, jealousy, and hatred. It is the forerunner of being able to let go. Now, there is a sense, isn't there, in that kind of restraint about what is our underlying sense of what we're committed to, what we value, more than self, more than being right. You know, I think in restraint there's a kind of tremendous willingness to put down the argument before we win it. That's not easy for us. You know, to put down the sort of short-sighted gratification in the service of the more long-term fruition of our capacity for kindness and compassion and respect and dignity. But it is truly a practice. It's not only a practice regarding others, it's a practice in relationship to ourselves. Think about how often we find our own minds and hearts governed by habits such as self-judgment, self-criticism, self-diminishing. These are actually acts of harm. What does it mean to restrain? To me, it's actually like no longer being willing to consent in that which brings harm to ourselves and others. It's no longer willing to be a participant in anything that we know undermines the dignity and respect of ourselves and others. It's like not volunteering for suffering. It's not easy. It's truly not easy. And it really is a commitment of mindfulness. Because when we look at certainly those moments, those moments of impulse and reactivity, very often they're not moments when there's much mindfulness there, is there? You know, and if you remember that part of the word sati, or part of the translation of sati, or mindfulness, is remembering. Remembering what we are committed to. Remembering what we most deeply value. This is where also restraint comes in. So you may have anything to say about restraint.
Mm-hmm.
think it's about not just about what we do, I think it's about what we don't do. You know, and I think, you know, that whole heat of the moment phrase, which is such a wonderful one, it's really talking about the fire of aversion. You know, the fire of craving, you know, the fire of selfing. That is really often the heat of the moment. I just, you know, it doesn't even pass through any kind of gates, does it? You know, it's just like, you know, that wonderful expression in Zen, you know, I open my mouth and samsara pops out. You know, it's kind of like this practice is about cooling the heat of the moment, you know. So, but this, you know, this is why, you know, the practice needs to be so ongoing. Because, you know, if we wait for crisis moments and think this is really a good place to be mindful, it's like John Kabat-Zinn says, you know, the time to weave your parachute is not when you're about to jump out of the plane. You know, if you haven't got that parachute ready, those crisis moments are going to be, take you. They're going to take you. And it's why, you know, we put so much emphasis upon, you know, developing that capacity for mindfulness as a resource, to be inwardly resourced. You know, the heat of the moment often... it's often showing us how we're not inwardly resourced enough to meet those really difficult moments that we all meet in our lives. You know, where habit and selfing just seems to just be a kind of tidal wave. So I don't think there is an easy answer to this, except, you know, this is why we walk this path. This is why we develop every aspect of this path. It's why we tell people, you know, it really does make a difference to, you know, sit every day. You know, it really does make a difference, you know, to keep deepening that inner resourcefulness that allows us to meet our lives. It's not easy.
Seems like there's some other level, or maybe it's something else besides residue that has to do with just being alive, like sickness, death, and sorrow, grieving, that really even leading the most, you know, ethical life, you're still going to be confronted with other things.
Yes. This practice is not going to make our lives perfect. It's not going to mean that we don't meet those conditions that are part of every life. What we are really taking care of is how we meet those inevitable afflictions, and I think really how we uproot the afflictions that are not inevitable, which has much to do with you know, fear and aversion and selfing. But I think, you know, my experience in this practice is that it's an enabling practice in the best sense, in enabling us to be able to respond rather than react, to be able to care for rather than to fear. Because it's not as if this practice is meant to sort of, you know, create this kind of ideal world where nothing difficult ever happens. Difficulties happen. But there is a sense, I think, even within the difficult, the most difficult in terms of, you know, sickness and loss and grief, where we know the very personal dimension of that pain, and we also know the universality of that pain. It doesn't make our pain less or diminish it in any way, but we know that this is the affliction of living in this life. In terms of how we do restraint, I just want to come back to that for a moment. Sometimes, you know, if we really know we're kind of prone to heat at the moment reactions, sometimes it's really, I want to say that sometimes there's some muscle in mindfulness. You know, it's not always just being gently present. Sometimes it just means that I don't say those words, or I don't do that action, you know, or I don't engage in that way, not because it's bad, wrong, but because we know that we will be taking care of the residues of that for time to come. And that can feel, it's different than suppression, because suppression is the unwillingness to see something. You know, and I think restraint is the willingness to see something, but the unwillingness to engage in something that we know is only going to create more suffering. You know, then it feels counterintuitive, but much of this path is actually what we would call counterintuitive.
Mm-hmm. I struggle a lot with this heat at a moment kind of restraint, and one thing that was helpful for me was paying attention to the very tiny little irritants that I never really thought about.
Yes.
And having mindfulness to those little smaller things that I actually can have a little bit more, I guess, energy over, sort of created the possibility for restraint.
Yes.
I didn't really expect that.
No, it's so true, and it's very good that you raise that, because it's like we cannot just wait for the big moments. All of these small moments, you know, the little moments of aversion, you know, the little thoughts that just we kind of might entertain, you know, that we know are not quite kind, but they don't really seem to matter, you know. Those are the moments where we're weaving our parachute. You know, those are the moments where we're really practicing, and somehow those moments are actually building an acquaintance, an intimacy with what it means not to follow the habitual. And somehow those moments do somehow sometimes surprise us, that the big moments somehow are more easily embraced.
Sometimes when I have the skill to practice restraint, I find later then that the residue is so strong. Can you talk about a skillful way to act with that residue?
Can you give me an example? You mean like you don't, like you someone says something to you and you might not say...
Well, last night you were talking about injustice.
Yeah.
So perhaps things like that. Perhaps discussions about injustice or politics, maybe with family members. Things like that. And practicing restraint, and then I find the residue later that comes out, it's this pattern that keeps coming. And I really try to practice afterwards.
And the pattern that might keep coming afterwards is that I really didn't want to hear this, or I should have said this, or what, you know, I really hated listening to this, or
all of you.
No, I'm sure we'll all be in those situations, but the restraint doesn't stop with not saying or reacting or speaking impulsively in the moment. The restraint has much to do with how we engage with the residues of that. You know, I mean, it's a very important point, because I'm sure everybody in this room can relate to that. You know, I mean, I remember sitting in my living room not long ago with my brother-in-law, who suddenly decided he was a racist. And I thought, this can't be happening in my house. And it's happening. Right, okay. And then introduce the entire tabloid, you know, tirade of views and opinions. And I thought, what am I going to do here? What am I going to do here? You know, and it was something about, you know, because my first response was, and I knew what would happen, you know, my first response was to dive in, you know, and, you know, and I knew what would happen. I knew that that would close the door for any possibility of any genuine meeting or discussion. So I didn't. And the next day, I went back to him. You know, when he wasn't in his heat of the moment. And that was an important piece. He wasn't in his heat of the moment. And I don't need to add my heat of the moment to somebody else's heat of the moment. But it doesn't mean that it's at the end of the story because we practice restraint. Because then we come next into this area of what is wise speech? You know, what is wise action? What is wise relationship? How do we approach this heat of the moment when it is approachable? So then we're coming into that whole domain of, you know, not, it's not just about swallowing. You know, restraint is not just about swallowing something. And I think sometimes that's what's leading to the go round, because there's been the stopping, which may have been the first step of restraint, which probably may be very useful and wise. But then what can happen afterwards, I think, is the sense we've just swallowed it. You know, so part of it is, okay, how do I practice restraint around my own obsessive mind? That's a big piece. You know, and I certainly think there are many ways that practice, and particularly I would say metta practice, is a huge ally in protecting our own mind from obsession. But it's also not the end of the story, because if something is left undone that actually needs to be done, or something that is left unaddressed that needs to be addressed, it is important for integrity to know how and the moment and the ways that we might do that. That's different than swallowing. I mean, these are, you know, these are the areas that matter in our lives. These are the areas that we practice in, and these are the areas that we investigate. This is not some sort of ivory tower type teaching, you know. Okay, we deal, meet difficult people in this life. And we're never going to not meet difficult people in this life. And so how are we going to actually approach that in the most ethical way that does the least harm, but that actually is saying no to the causes of suffering?
I can feel the self-righteousness, you know, and the I and the, you know, in that judging. And I mean, even now, yeah. Just talking about it, I can feel it in my chest.
Yeah.
And then there's this sense that, well, I won't go around there anymore, you know, and which is more self-righteousness and more. I try to think, oh, well, that's the wise thing to do is just stay away, but really that's the pushing. And it's tricky. It's just tricky, like you're saying.
It's very difficult. Yeah. It's very difficult. And one needs to actually not only keep an eye on, you know, there are times when it's probably appropriate to stay away. You know, there are probably times when it's appropriate to stay away. It's not necessarily an act of fear or an act of aversion. It may be actually a wise choice. But we also need to see that, you know, some of the difficult people in this world we can avoid, and some of the difficult people in this world are right in our families. They're right in our families, and perpetual avoidance is not really an option that we can also live with. You know, but it's kind of like the, you know, it's kind of like the nettle rash, you know, that doesn't just go away. You know, we need to keep coming back to it and keep coming back to it. But it's almost like this is our training ground, because, you know, we cannot change the heart and mind of another person. And I think that's part of what we need to acknowledge and accept. We are not going to change the heart and mind of another person. But we can embody our own heart and mind and speak it and act it. And maybe, who knows, maybe that plants some seeds that changes the heart and the mind of ill will, not of another person, but the heart and mind of ill will. And I think there's something here about taking the person out, you know, my brother-in-law, you know, my mother, you know, or my difficult sister. There's something about taking the person out of it. What we're really talking about here is, how do we meet ill will? You know, how do we meet fear? You know, how do we meet greed, wherever it might arise? It's almost when it comes down to my brother-in-law, it gets really complicated, because I feel some responsibility about, you know, he's my brother-in-law. I can't have a brother-in-law who thinks like this. I have a brother-in-law who thinks like this. Isn't that something? Yeah. But it's actually about, you know, there's something so universal about, you know, that ill will, that possibility of ill will and fear. And someone said that's what we're training ourselves to meet. Yeah, but also restraint from our own obsessions. It's really important. And, you know, I just really want to almost kind of like repeat this, creating moments of psychological, emotional opportunity. The possibility of walking a different pathway.
Could you share anything of your conversation the following day with
the board? Yeah, it didn't go anywhere. And that's almost what you're saying, you know. I don't go back the next day with the expectation, now I'm really cool now, you know, and great, you know, now I'm going to find exactly the right words, it's going to change his heart and mind. No, it didn't go anywhere. And that's almost creating that space, just to know the sadness of that. Just another sentence of that. But he can come back to my house. You know, and not feel that I hate him. You know, maybe that's something. I think also we may get into this more when we talk about equanimity, if we ever get there in this this weekend. Because it's a big piece of this, isn't it?
So it seems to me in all of this that there are some things for which we must have zero tolerance.
Yes.
And could you address, I mean, there are some things that in the moment are simply unacceptable. I can't simply restrain and say, well, I'll come back to that. They must be confronted in this moment. Could you address?
I think it's so important. I mean, this is absolutely true. You know, and this, isn't this the kind of real difficulty, the real challenge of our practice? I mean, it's not, you know, if I walk out of here and somebody is abusing somebody outside, it is no help for that person that I am really engaging in restraint and being very mindful of, you know, seeing. There are situations actually where there is the need, there is no other choice. I want to get out of this word need out of the way. There is no other choice. Something, there is such immediacy to the suffering, it must end. It is no different than, you know, pulling back a child who's about to fall over a cliff. You know? But this is the challenge for many of us. It's the challenge, I think, where the possibility of fear taking hold is much different than restraint in terms of stopping wise action. It's the challenge for all of us of how does mindfulness engage with wise action in moments and situations that cannot afford the luxury of our returning tomorrow. You know, if we see someone being abused, if we see something happening which is completely unacceptable in the sense that it perpetuates and causes suffering. You know, and often, you know, many people in practice find themselves extremely uncomfortable in backing away from those moments because of fear. You know, what do you do if you see someone about to be mugged on a bus? You know, and turn away because I might get hurt. And it is why, you know, so much part is, and we will get into this more, you know, how much mindfulness is something more than just being present, you know, and about how this path is something much more about being present, you know. And if you look actually at the kind of teaching stories of compassion, it is actually really being willing to step beyond the boundaries of that fear and say no. And there is a risk in that. There is a risk in that. But what often kind of stops us from saying, I mean, and I'm, you know, we're talking about very specific circumstances here. But often we will back away from addressing the difficult because of the fear of selfing. Is this a hard path? And sometimes we need to be willing to do that. We don't know what will happen. But that's almost as if, again, there's no choice. There's no choice. But it's conscious. It's conscious. It's intentional. It's arising from a sense of protecting from harm. And often it's not ourselves we are protecting from harm. It's another. So this first training in Sila is restraint. The second dimension of Sila is a much more conscious and intentional undertaking of cultivating the skillful and the wholesome. And when the Buddha talked about Sila, he spoke of it as bodily, verbal, and mental acts of friendliness. Bodily, verbal, and mental acts of kindness. In Shantideva, it said, wholesome and unwholesome actions keep on happening through our mouths, through our hands, our minds, as we move and as we stay still. Basically, what's being said is that it's important to acknowledge that we are always practicing something. We are always practicing something. And we are either practicing the tired old reactions and habits that have repeated themselves countless times through our lives, or we are consciously practicing that which we understand leads to the end of suffering for ourselves and others. But it's important to acknowledge we are always practicing something. And it's either conscious or not conscious. And the whole direction of this practice is to bring what we are practicing into the light of awareness, into the light of mindfulness. As Shantideva put it, only by checking with great mindfulness, vigilance, and care do we live in a skillful way. He went on to say, whatever you are doing, wherever you are, ask yourself, what is the state of my mind? What is the state of my mind? Accomplish the skillful and liberating. This is the path of the bodhisattvas. It is sometimes, you know, in the Tibetan tradition, it's sometimes said that the whole of this path pivots on the head of the pin of intention. And one of those intentions is really the intention of kindness and compassion, or two of the kindness and compassion. So restraint, consciously cultivating the skillful and the wholesome. Bringing the intention to bring benefit to others. The intention to bring benefit to others. As the Dalai Lama once said, if you want to be happy, cultivate the happiness of others. When we really see or really are able to act and speak free of self-righteousness, free in selfing, we actually see no separation between self and others. Then sila, or ethics, is the natural, unshakable climate of the mind inclined towards benefiting others. And this is where sila is so related to generosity. Now, the Buddha, as I mentioned, described ethics in the light of metta, as words, acts, and thoughts of boundless friendliness. In the Tibetan tradition, it says nowhere on the earth is it safe to spit. I hope you get that metaphor. It's basically you're always at the risk of the wind being against you. Shantideva says, do not take lightly small misdeeds, small moments on wandering from the path of the skillful, believing they can do no harm, that even a tiny spark of fire can set alight a mountain. Showing respect in all moments, do not take lightly small good deeds, small moments of generosity and care and mindfulness, believing they can hardly help. For drops of water, one by one, in time will fill an ocean. There is... I want to... I think this is important to... You very rarely see in the early discourses actually the word anger. What you see is ill will. Ill will. And I think this is a very important distinction to make, particularly when it comes to, you know, meeting injustice, meeting that which is unacceptable. I mean, ill will we can really see is the territory of selfing. It is actually, you know, born of self-righteousness, the desire to hurt in some way another, the desire to strike out, to create alienation and separation. Ill will is always that pushing away that leaves so much residue in the mind. We might call it inappropriate anger. And what we really see is that when there is ill will, we are really locked in that imprisonment of self and other. As Shantideva says, nothing can make a person rooted in ill will happy. As long as the thorn of ill will lives in the heart, we cannot find peace or joy. Now, there is anger with injustice. There is anger with oppression. And I think a person who has never felt disturbed by injustice or oppression is somehow a person who is somehow alienated inwardly from compassion and interdependence. It's never really been touched deeply by the plight of others. So Dalai Lama once said it, and I think we need to be so careful with this. He says, anger can be the beginning of powerful altruistic acts of healing. That should never be used as a way that my anger is always appropriate. You know, we need to be so honest in ourselves in discerning the difference between ill will and anger that is the beginning of powerful altruistic acts of healing. That's a very fine line within ourselves. I think that only we can know. But I think the Dalai Lama is really saying that anger can be of being deeply touched and shaken by suffering, can be the catalyst for wise action and speech. But we know that wise action and speech is very rarely born of an agitated mind, very rarely born of ill will. Instead, we get unwise action and speech. Shantideva goes on to say, the bodhisattva who breaks the training precepts out of ill will has abandoned all sentient beings. Bodhisattvas should not be afraid of passions, which help them hold sentient beings in the embrace of compassion, but should fear passions that lead them to forsake anyone. Good one, isn't it? Not fear the passions which help us to hold sentient beings in the embrace of compassion, but should fear the passions that lead us to forsake anyone. What are we restraining from? Unskillful bodily actions, harming, taking what is not freely given, misuse of sensual pleasure. Verbal actions we are restraining from that are untrue, slanderous, harsh, or idle. The mental actions we are restraining from of greed, ill will, and unwise view. What do we cultivate? Thoughts, words, and acts rooted in kindness and in the insight of knowing what leads to suffering and what leads to the end of suffering. If this does not challenge us or make us uncomfortable, I think the implications of sila haven't been understood. We also begin to see how sila asks for remarkable mindfulness and how the unwholesome and unskillful flourish in a climate of heedlessness and forgetfulness. And that is really the path, is to cultivate the heedfulness and the mindfulness.